Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the confidential Justice Department memo leaked to NBC News that authorizes the U.S. government to order the killing of American citizens if they are believed to be al-Qaeda leaders, even if there is no intelligence that they are actively involved in a plot to attack the United States. Bradley J. Strausser, a professor in the Defense Analysis Department at the United States Naval Postgraduate School and author of Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military, joins us to discuss targeted killing, an issue that is bound to dominate Thursday's confirmation hearing of John Brennan to head up the CIA. Then we are joined in the studio by the filmmakers of the Academy Award-nominated documentary feature Five Broken Cameras. Palestinian farmer and cameraman Ahmad Bernat and Israeli documentary filmmaker Guy Davidi discuss their powerful film that documents the encroachment of Israeli settlers on a Palestinian village where Ahmad and his wife and four sons live. Five Broken Cameras reveals the shocking ground truth of the Israeli-Palestinian struggle, provided by the five cameras Ahmad uses, as one by one of them are destroyed by the Israeli army over a six-year period, while Palestinian villagers are beaten and killed by Israelis with impunity as they engage in nonviolent protest trying to protect their farms, homes, and families. Joining us now is Dr. Bradley J. Strausser, who's an assistant professor in the Defense Analysis Department at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's also a research associate at Oxford University's Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and previously taught philosophy at the United States Air Force Academy and the University of Connecticut. His forthcoming book is Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Bradley J. Strausser.
Thanks for having me.
And this memo that was a 16-page memo from the Justice Department that was leaked to NBC News, apparently it's titled Lawfulness of a Lethal Operation Directed Against a U.S. Citizen Who is a Senior Operational Leader of al-Qaeda or an Associated Force. Now, my understanding is that this memo was given to members of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee. So I think it's reasonable to assume that the leak came from there. But there's a bipartisan group of 11 senators led by Democrat Ron Wyden of Oregon who have written to the president asking him to release all Justice Department memos on the subjects of drones and targeted killings. So this looks to me like perhaps somebody's trying to force the president's hand here. What's your reading on it?
Yes, as you just described it, that's my best understanding of it as well. It's entirely possible the leak is from someone on one of the Senate committees you just mentioned. It's also, of course, possible that someone from within the White House or within the program itself, who knows. It's unclear exactly what, for example, Senator Wyden is after. They do speak of the memos in the plural. That's an important point to make here. And then this DOG white paper, I'm sorry, Department of Justice white paper, is not the memo, for example, that was used to justify various killings. The thought here is there must be classified specific memos for specific cases. But what people like, for example, Scott Shane at the New York Times and others have reported is that the legal reasoning in this this white paper parallels that which is used in the classified memos. Now, I should say, Senator Wyden, it's interesting that he was part of the senators asking for the Obama administration to release more memos because he is on the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And the SSCI, as it's sometimes referred to, they don't like it if you call them the SISI, but the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, they have the power to have really anything they want disclosed to them by these operations, being any covert action taken by the CIA or the executive branch. They have the power over them to really demand anything they want, and they can stop these programs if they want. It's important to remember back in the 80s, under the Reagan administration and the Boland Amendment, when the Senate did kind of flex its muscle and enforce this power. They control the funding for it. If they wanted to, they could cut off the funding for the program and kind of force the administration's hand here. That's why I'm just so confused by it. I'm not sure what memos they have seen. I'm not sure what they haven't. I'm not sure what intelligence they've been briefed on. But it would be very odd to me if they've gone and demanded certain intelligence briefings on these actual operations and haven't been given it by the CIA. Now, it's possible the White House is not providing all the memos. But again, if that is the case, the SSCI could They could demand this, and they have the administrative power and tools at their means to really force a hand if they wanted to. So the fact that they haven't done so, but yet they continue to make these public statements of saying, hey, we need more transparency, I'm really confused as to the domestic politics on it, to be quite frank with you. I'm not sure what's really going on between the Senate Committee on Intelligence and the White House here.
And, of course, this is all happening a couple of days in advance of Thursday's Senate nomination hearings for John Brennan to head up the CIA. And probably nobody in the U.S. government knows more about the drone program than John Brennan, right?
Yes, absolutely. The timing of these public statements against the White House about releasing these memos has to, of course, be it's not a coincidence that it coincides with John Brennan's confirmation hearings, nor perhaps Chuck Hagel's either. It does seem like there's some political theater going on. I would just stress that it's not just these senators and the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee, but the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, as well as the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. They both have the power to demand to be fully disclosed on any of these things, and if they feel like they're not getting the information they need to be a proper oversight over these kind of programs, they have the power, they have the administrative tools, a broad number of them, in fact, such that they could stop the White House from doing this. So the fact that they're not doing that, but yet they keep demanding more transparency is odd to me. I'm not sure what's going on. I have a feeling that they actually are briefed in far more than they are admitting. But of course, in this controversial topic, I think all politicians would rather have just the White House hold the political bag and not have themselves have to, you know, bear any of the burden of saying that they're approving this or overseeing it, because that implicates them as well in this controversial program.
Well, I would share with you my skepticism along those lines. It feels like they want to look like they're on the side of wanting more disclosure, but frankly, they don't really want to know about it, and they're perfectly happy to leave the ambiguity with the president, which just seems to be where it is, right? It's essentially, we don't know exactly what the mechanics are, but I believe the president is provided with a list, and he ultimately has to make the decision. But it's worth, I think, putting this in the broader context of this has been a part of presidential power in the post-war period, has it not? The ability of a president to essentially press a button he still has the attaché case called the football following him around. And, of course, in that case, nuclear war would involve the death of considerably people than target assassinations do. So give us a sense of where this stands in history of presidential powers over life and death matters.
Well, I would agree with some of what you just said. I would be careful, though, with some of the ways it's been portrayed as sort of a hit list by some people, that the president just sits down every Tuesday in these meetings and picks somebody. I don't think that's quite accurate. From my understanding is that there's these really complicated streams of intelligence constantly coming in and being evaluated, and they're trying to evaluate different threats. This is mainly the CIA, but as well as the other intelligence agencies through a variety of intelligence sources, trying to evaluate different threats and then trying to ascertain what are the best ways to block those threats. And then those different means or opportunities of blocking those threats, I think, are then presented up and down throughout the executive branch and within the CIA itself. And then I think the president is involved in some of those discussions. But I think it's constantly changing and evolving depending on their intelligence for the threat. So I wouldn't put it in those terms as just like a list that the president picks from. But I do agree that it's certainly perhaps an unsettling thing to think about, this kind of power. I would note, however, that this, I don't think it really is anything new in the broader question of a state killing people that it takes to be an imminent threat. That is to say, I think the conversation over drones here is a little bit of a red herring. I don't think it matters in this broader discussion whether or not it's drones or a sniper carrying out this policy. I think what should really concern us here, the more important question, is what terms, in this case from this white paper, the Department of Justice and the executive branch more broadly, is using to define and measure and evaluate imminence or imminent threat. Are they talking about an imminent threat like, for example, this recent hostage situation in Alabama where this guy, Jimmy Lee Dykes, he had a gun on a child in his underground prison. Is it that kind of imminent threat? You know, in that moment, the police in that situation, they decided that for whatever information they have, which I'm not sure what it was, but they decided that he was an imminent threat and a danger to this child, so they took action and they killed him. Now, no one in that case is arguing that his due process rights were violated or that he was somehow failed to, you know, be granted habeas corpus. Everybody, I think, agrees in that case. He was clearly an imminent threat. But is that what they mean by imminent threat, or are they taking a much fuzzier, broader definition and evaluation of imminent threat, similar to perhaps how the Bush administration claimed with Saddam Hussein using WMDs as a justification for Iraq war? It seems like, just, and I'm not a legal scholar, but it seems like in reading the white paper that they're taking a much broader definition. In fact, they say that explicitly. We're taking a much broader definition of imminent threat. But the idea that a state has the political power to kill a person who is posing an imminent threat of unjustified harm to innocent people, that really, in principle anyway, isn't new. It's the way that they're defining that language and making that legal justification that is perhaps new.
But along with this elastic definition of imminent threat in these leaked documents from the Department of Justice, there's also this idea that the targeting of these people means that that capture must be unfeasible before they can be hit a drone. And my understanding of the rationale for the capture being unfeasible is, people say in the Pakistani territories near the Afghan border, more people would get killed trying to capture them than perhaps even the target cells would be killed. Therefore, the drone is the instrument of choice. Is that the rationale?
I think that's right. And that actually rationale has been promulgated by the White House since they first admitted to the drone campaign in both media reports and in interviews and in press conferences. They've said that for a long time. They've argued that, look, drones appear to be more capable of being more precise, more accurate, and cause less unintended harm to innocent civilians and bystanders than other alternatives. And moreover, they seem to be defining infeasible when they say, let me just go back really quickly. The white paper says that there are actually three things that need to be met. One, they have to, the targeted individual must pose an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States. And as I said, I think the real crux of this is, how are they measuring this concept of imminent? Is it the way most of us would think of imminent threat, or is it this really broadened, a loose definition of imminent threat? Many of us would take to be an abuse of the concept. But that's just the first one. The second one is, they say, like you just mentioned, capture must be infeasible. And then third, they say that it has to be conducted within the classic fundamental principles of the laws of war, such as necessitation and proportionality. But on the question of feasible capture, these questions, again, in principle, new. In the recent case, again, in Alabama with Jimmy Lee Dykes, who was just killed, took the child hostage in Alabama, I'm sure part of the consideration for deciding on whether or not to go in and use lethal force against this guy was, well, if we try to capture him, will that actually cause more harm, perhaps to the child or perhaps to law enforcement officers? So the same kind of considerations and calculations, of course, are being made here, and that's really all the white paper is claiming. The problem many people have with this, and I respect this concern a great deal, is that they fear that that kind of language is being abused to justify perhaps a drone strike simply because it'd be easier to do, but not because, in fact, capture would be more infeasible. And I think that's the danger and that's the worry, that that's being abused. But the principle behind it, again, is not really a new or radical claim, that you need to consider all the different risks that would come with capture over killing in any given case and what harm the likelihood of either of those options would produce. And I think we're obligated in any case to always err on the side of that which we think will predictably cause the least amount of harm to people involved.
So you've clearly studied this subject at length, Dr. Bradley J. Strosser. What's your explanation for the deeply felt outrage that a lot of Americans feel about drones? I mean, my sense is that I'm not entirely sure that sticking a bayonet in somebody's guts and watching them die is more honorable than killing somebody with a drone, but there's no question that the outrage is felt, and my understanding is that on the targeted side of it, it probably might well cause more jihadis to be recruited because it gives those people that are being targeted a sense of being so helpless against this unseen power out there that they're likely to be more enraged and humiliated than they are to want to sort of give up being jihadis or whatever.
Right, I agree. It's a tremendous concern. I think you've put your finger on a great deal of the outrage that is felt in both the areas of the world where drones are used and by American people. This thought that the efforts of the drone campaign might very well be counterproductive because they produce more backlash than anything they might, than any threats they might be stopping, could very well be true. People have been long arguing that. And you remember, very similar arguments were made with U.S. operations in Iraq and in other places. But I think the issue with drones for a lot of people is precisely the asymmetry you just pointed out, that there's this really radical asymmetry going on when one person in a fight doesn't even have any kind of human risk in the actual theater of operations where it's being carried out, that literally the people piloting the drones are on the other side of the world. I will say, however, that I think focusing on the drone part of this policy is actually a distraction. I think, again, it's not really about drones. The question is, what kind of policy do we want our state carrying out to kill people who they take to be imminent threat? And in that question, of course, I think we have right to demand, how are they measuring imminent threat? What are the definitions and terms used for imminent threat? And what is the evidence behind it? Of course, the problem with that is that the reasons that they're going to point to for saying, hey, this person is an imminent threat and that's why we felt that we had to kill them, of course, that data is classified, and they're going to claim national security reasons to keep it classified. So we're in this difficult situation where we need to have checks and balances and oversight. And again, I believe there is with the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, but in the public discussion, we're kind of stuck. We don't see what the evidence they have is to make this kind of claim, and they don't feel like they have a right to divulge it. Why are drones so crucial? There's a long conversation there about the psychology of it. But I think whether or not we as an American public should be, what our conversation should be over this is regarding the policy itself. You know, what the questions we should be asking our government and ourselves are not about drone technology, but about what moral imperatives should guide our defense policy and our defense philosophy as a state. The technology that's used to carry it out, I think the moral questions here really are the same. Again, whether it's a manned aircraft or an unmanned aircraft or whether it's a sniper, I think the moral principles behind it are not going to change. And those are the questions we really need to ask and demand from our government. And I think we're starting to finally see some of that come to light with this policy, with this white paper.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Bradley J. Strasser, what about this fact that technological advantages are always somewhat fleeting? You know, we had a monopoly on the atomic bomb for a while, and then the Russians got it. In this case, you know, 53 or 51 countries have drones, and it's I just was wondering how, in terms of blowback or technological advances by others, how would we feel if a Chinese drone was flying over LA somewhere, you know, looking for somebody that the Chinese government didn't like? And I mean, are we going to eventually have to be faced with those questions?
Well, the short answer, I think, is yes. We are going to have to face those questions. Unfortunately, military technology doesn't have a great track record of being contained. Now, I do think we can get out in front of some of the proliferation of any new military technology, and I commend the efforts of some people to do that. For example, there's the International Committee on Robot Arms Control, and a colleague of mine, Noel Sharkey, the chairman of that, amongst many other fine people, and they're working towards, let's set up some international treaties now. Let's get out ahead of the curve on this. But certainly, it seems like this technology is going to proliferate and it's not going to go away anytime soon because it has these clear military advantages. But in terms of your analogy of how would we feel about a Chinese drone flying over LA looking for somebody the Chinese government doesn't like, of course that would be awful, but I don't think that's apt. It's important to remember in these cases that, for example, in Yemen, where we're carrying out a lot of drone strikes right now, that Yemen and the United States are allies in this fight. And at least officially, you know, the Yemeni government claims that they are asking for the United States' help and working together as partners in trying to carry out these drone operations to find these terrorists that they are trying to block the what they claim to be an imminent threat from. So the analogy to China would only work if it was a situation where the United States and China were working together, say, to find somebody in Los Angeles that both nation states took to be a threat, that both nation states were trying to fight. So that's why it's important to remember in these cases that as much as the local populations of Yemen and Pakistan and the other areas where drone operations are going on may radically and passionately object to this policy, that officially the governments of these nations are allied with the United States in this effort and are working together. And that does radically change, I think, at least for many people, the way you think about these drone operations being carried out, that if Pakistanis are angry with drone strikes being carried out in the Fatah region, for example, they need to be frustrated just as much with Islamabad as they do with Washington, D.C.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Dr. Bradley J. Strasser.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Bradley J. Strasser, who is an assistant professor in the Defense Analysis Department at the United States Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's also a research associate at Oxford University's Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and taught philosophy at the United States Air Force Academy and in the University of Connecticut. His forthcoming book is Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Ahmad Banat, who is a Palestinian farmer and freelance cameraman and photographer. He has filmed for TV channels such as Al Jazeera, Israeli channels 1, 2, and 10, and Palestinian television. He's also worked with Reuters on several occasions and filmed footage for the documentaries Berlin, My Love, Palestine's Kids, Open Close, and Interrupted Streams. And also in the studio is Guy Davidi, who was born in Jaffa, Israel. He's a documentary filmmaker and cinema teacher. He's been directing, editing, and shooting films since the age of 16. And as a cameraman, he shot the films Hamza and Journal d'une Orange for France 3. Davidi also directed many short documentaries such as In Working Progress, Keywords, and Women Defying Barriers, which were presented in film festivals and venues worldwide. In 2010, Guy Davidi's first feature film, Interrupted Streams, premiered to great acclaim at the Jerusalem International Film Festival. And recently, he's launched a campaign to bring his Academy Award-nominated feature documentary, Five Broken Cameras, to Israeli youth. And I take it you also want to get your film screened on Israeli television. And I imagine if you win the Academy Award, it'll give it a boost, but was that going to guarantee it?
The film was co-produced with Channel 8, so it was already shown in Israeli television in a documentary channel. But my biggest wish from the Oscar would be to put it on a broadcast channel, meaning one of the main two channels in Israel, and that would be amazing politically, historically, and for the film. So yeah, that's one of the achievement that I hope to get from the Oscars.
Well, for me, as a sort of objective observer, since I'm here in the United States, although obviously in the United States there's a fairly strong pro-Israel bias in terms of sympathy, nevertheless, I was so shocked by the film. I was really disturbed by it. And it felt to me like I was seeing for the first time a whole other side of this story that we've heard for so long about this plucky, brave little country under siege from all of these crazy Arabs who want to kill everybody. And it's so much different. The shoe is very much on the other foot. The Israelis are the victimizers and the Palestinians are the victims.
Yeah, there are a lot of stories that, especially here in the U.S., that the media is not really reporting and concentrating mainly on the violence movement and violence resistance, while there is in Palestine for many years a very strong, impressive nonviolent movement, and they are joined by international and Israeli activists. And this is not well reported in the media, and it was mediatized a little bit in Berlin. I think that was what was the big success of this village, that it managed with a lot of creativeness to bring more media, to create more media attention, but it's still something that needs to be developed.
And Ahmad Banat, you're a farmer turned filmmaker. That's an unusual journey. And you have documented the life in your village, and the film is incredibly powerful because you start out, in 2005 with your first of five cameras, all of which ended up being broken or shot or whatever throughout the course of the film. Your children, your four boys, the youngest is very young at the time. But you look across at the Israeli encroaching settlements, this wall of big high-rise settlements. And you really do feel the encroachment as the film progresses. Your land is being taken away from you, and your life is being so impacted, and your friends throughout the film are shot, killed, but you still stick to this nonviolent approach. So I guess my first question is, how long can you maintain your nonviolent approach given the violence that's meted out against you and your fellow villagers?
You know, we've been through this so long time since my childhood. I've been through this situation, and I live many different experience. So it seems like the situation is getting worse and worse. And I decided myself to take the camera and to film and to document and to be part of the struggle in my village as one who lived there. This is my life and this is my place, so I have to do something. So it was my responsibility to film and to protect people with my camera and to show the footage for the world. I am talking about my life, about my family life, about my friends, about my village, and it's very unique story. It's not just a political issue. I didn't want to focus in more on the political issue because there's were many films made about the subject, about the wall, about Palestine, but most of these films made by people who come from outside, and they never know they never feel the same feeling, and they didn't live the reality, the experience. So I live there. I was born there, and my son born there also, and he was growing in this situation. So I wanted to show this the story, and I wanted to make the story and the film from my personal perspective and to show the people how the life is, how the reality is. It's a very simple how we live there and how's the situation. Because people just get news and they just get information about political issues or violence, or they didn't really know the real situation in Palestine.
So, Guy Davidi, how did you come to meet Ahmad, and how did this project evolve? Because what's powerful about it is just sitting here opposite you two, an Israeli and a Palestinian, who collaborated to make this extraordinary film. Ahmad is not alone in his struggle. There are international peace activists and Israeli peace activists that sort of show up occasionally at these demonstrations, which seem to go on all the time. That seems to be the impression you get. Just as the buildings encroach from with the settlers and are moving forward, on you all the time throughout this film, you're also experienced just this endless battle and the incredibly creative way that the Palestinians engage in nonviolent struggle against what seems to be an overwhelmingly powerful adversary.
Yeah, I was from 2003, I discovered first time the West Bank and what's happening there in person when I joined the Israeli activists going to different villages to show support, to participate in demonstration. And it's a small movement, but I think we met a lot of stories and a lot of sad stories and inspiring people where, regardless to all the suffering that they've experienced, they are choosing every day to collaborate. It's a very bad word, but it's a true, honest kind of collaboration in order to resist the occupation. So I had a lot of encounters like that. And in 2005, when the movement got to Berlin, I joined. I went to Berlin quite early, and I was impressed by the hospitality of the people and by the communication that we developed with people like Ahmad. Since I'm a filmmaker, I started doing short films, and then I ended up doing this film, Interrupted Streams, that dealt with the water, the politics of the water. And I chose this subject, which is a transparent element of the occupation, because I felt the nonviolent movement was actually quite mediatized, and there were a lot of cameramen that were filming that. And so I didn't think that I have a place there. So I chose a subject that allowed me to go more into private life of people and family life. And through this film, I discovered, I stayed in Belin for a few months. And through the period of time that I worked on that film, I discovered a lot of things that later on helped to shape Five Broken Cameras as well. But then I met Imad, and he was a very important figure in the movement, because he was the only cameraman that was part of the village and not just visiting and not passing a time like I passed, but all the time he was there filming. So he was very important, and he was encouraged by a lot of other activists and filmmakers to continue on working. So I think it was natural that after he saw a lot of films that were released about the subject, most notably Belin My Love in 2006 by Israeli filmmaker Shai Carmeli Polak, who is a friend of us. And I think he felt he wanted to tell his story, and so he continued on to film. And in after a few years, in 2009, he approached me to offer me to do this, to do a film about the nonviolent movement. And actually, as an Israeli, I wasn't sure how it will be to work with a Palestinian, because I mean it's his story and it's village, and why should I be there involved in that? So actually, I thought that if he would be in the center of the film, and his voice would be the voice who tells the film, and it will be a much more personal film. Politically, it will be much more interesting for me, because I will be there to empower his voice, to give him more space, and which is professionally a very tough position, because you have to put yourself always in a modest way and always to give him the space. But I felt that this is what the story needed, and it's his life work after all. He filmed throughout these years, not me. So that's a good decision that we had, and that's the type of relation that we had. So it's not a balanced Israeli-Palestinian film or a balanced Israeli-Palestinian filmmaker. It's a story. It's a Palestinian story. It's his story, and I'm there to help him to raise his voice.
Again, I'm speaking with the filmmakers of the Academy Award-nominated documentary Five Broken Cameras, Imad Bernat, a Palestinian farmer and freelance cameraman, and Guy Davidi, who is an Israeli filmmaker. And Imad, throughout the film, your friends, Efil, the elephant, one of the great characters, he's shot by the Israelis, which is shocking. And another friend of yours, or I think a relative, is, as he's being arrested and put into the paddy wagon, a soldier a couple of feet away just casually shoots him in the leg with his rifle. So the film shows a kind of callousness, which really shocked me on the part of the Israeli soldiers. And many of your friends, including Efil, I think before he's killed, he's shouting out to the Israeli soldiers, "You just shot an Israeli girl, you know, captain, you know," and then suddenly he's dead. So what I found powerful was the appeals by your friends and villagers right up in the faces of the Israeli soldiers, asking them about their humanity. From your point of view, has that ever worked? Have you ever sensed that the people that are doing this to you on a daily basis and to your villages and your Palestinian extended family, is it getting to them? Is it affecting them? Because just me as a viewer, I was deeply affected by it.
I think, as you said before, it's a story, it's a film about the humanity more than political. So it's a story about the life and the village and the friends. And so everything was related to me, and everything affected me, affected my friends, what happens in the village. And I think if we talk about the humanity, it's very difficult to kill somebody or to in the same time to feel that humanity. So if you have humanity inside, you never do wrong things, or you never do kill people. So it's different when you see the soldiers, and when you see the soldiers how they use violence or how they kill your friend. It's very difficult, but I never felt that humanity from soldiers. They just shot and they use violence, and they don't care about what's gonna happen. So it's very difficult. I didn't want to to tell, you know, to show the film as a political film. I wanted to show it from humanity and from the daily life and the reality, how the people live there. And it's about friends, about family, about life in small village. And to follow the characters for a long time, for 7 years, and to follow my son Jibril, this is the idea was since the beginning. So to make a film like this, humanity, about personal perspective, about daily life. And so Adib was arrested and Phil was killed, and they were related to me. We were friends, very close friends, but I never know that Phil gonna be killed. So I was filming him, following him for years, and for to make this film. But I was shocked when he got killed, as everybody in the village. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to see your friend died, or to see another your friend got arrested, or your son growing up in this situation and facing the soldiers.
Well, Guy Davini, it struck me at the time that in many ways, it sort of felt to me, just in a political, historical context, a bit like the civil rights struggles here in the United States in the South, in the sense that you had nonviolent protesters, African Americans, protesting against Southern sheriffs, if you will. And the idea that you could kill a black American and get away with it was so much a part of that struggle, and to bring a kind of legality to the situation. Your film is not, obviously, that is not an accurate analogy to compare it to the civil rights struggles, because there's still a legal context. The courts are still involved in a land dispute that Ahmad and his other Palestinians have brought into the Israeli courts. When he's wounded, he goes to an Israeli hospital where they save his life. But on the other hand, you know, the idea that the military, who may, you know, some of them may not find what they're doing particularly, you know, the kind of duties that you expect in the military. You're supposed to defend your country, not beat the hell out of civilians. But at the end of the day, the idea that they can shoot people with impunity really, I found troubling. And I'm just trying to figure out who's in charge here in this thing. You've got settlers who seem to be free to be able to meet out violence. You've got the courts that seem to be trying to restrain things, and there seems to be some rule of law. But on the other hand, you have these extrajudicial killings that are going on apparently regularly.
It's a very complicated issue, because it's true that there is organization behind things that are happening. So, of course, that you see some kind of decision, for instance, to raise violence in certain area or certain period of time, as I think we're experiencing right now at the moment. In the West Bank, we see there were a lot of killings lately, and you see there are in different locations different killings, and then at the same time you read in the media that there is preparation for intifada, which is not what's happening on the surface. So you see that there is kind of a politics that comes maybe from the government, maybe from the military. It's not very clear. But after that, also, there is also a lot of chaos in this. And there's a lot of freedom of you can behave whatever you want and you're not going to be accused. So even if it doesn't serve anything logical, any interest or anything, you're still going to see a lot of eruptions of violence and casual violence and chaos, just because people are allowed to do whatever they want and they are not going to be punished. So, you know, so they release all their shadows out. And then everyone who has violence urges or have hatred in him, he can express that the way he wants, and he won't be charged with anything, and he won't suffer consequences for that. If you're a soldier and you're trying to restrain your soldiers, then you might be charged with your commander that will tell you, no, you have to do your job, you have to charge right now, you have to shoot. So these are the extremists that have more freedom to act the way they want, less than the more moderate soldiers that are maybe not comfortable with that position, of course.
Well, let's take a brief station break, and we'll continue the conversation after a moment with Ahmad Banat and Guy Davidi.
and time and time we see these acts against humanity. Well, each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. Well, on and on and on we go. Well, some will you see and some won't be. True for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us again to continue the conversation are the filmmakers of the Academy Award-nominated feature documentary Five Broken Cameras, Ahmad Banat, who is a Palestinian farmer and freelance cameraman. He's worked for Al Jazeera, Israeli channels 1, 2, and 10, and Palestinian television as well. And Guy Davidi, who is an Israeli documentary filmmaker and cinema teacher. And he has made a number of films, including shot the films Hamza and Journal d'une Orange for France 3. And he has directed a feature film, Interrupted Streams, which premiered to great acclaim at the Jerusalem International Film Festival. And he is also involved in a campaign to bring the documentary feature he's made with Ahmad, Five Broken Cameras, to Israeli youth. And just starting with you, Ahmad, it's just been announced today by the White House that President Obama will visit Palestine, Israel, and Jordan within the next month or so. When I saw your film, I thought to myself, I wish the President of the United States saw this film. I really do. What are the chances of getting this film to him?
You know, many people ask me what you are going to what you want. What you want to buy this film? Who want you to want to watch the film? So I tell them always, I want everybody to watch the film. All the people, the normal people, and the politician, and the famous people, and I want also the president to watch the film. I want the film inside the White House to be there, so for the people in the White House, Obama and the politician people to watch this film. So important that people like Obama or politician people watch this film and know more about the life, about the Palestinian life, to get more about reality. And I know that they just get about political things and political issues, and they didn't get to know about the real life of our life, the Palestinian life, how our kids grow up there, how the situation affected them, and how the people live there in their daily life, every day. So it's very important for me to show the film everywhere, even for the President Obama or in Israel, to the Israeli government. And I hope that makes sense for them and make change.
And Guy Davidi, the film, you're making it available on DVDs at Netflix, iTunes, Hulu, Amazon, Google, and also at other video and demands outlets. So you're trying to get this out to as many people as possible. And you were saying earlier that you still hope to get it shown on a major Israeli television venue. And you're trying to also get it into the Israeli schools. What happens when you see this film is, as I say, a whole kind of window opens to another narrative, which we're not really getting over here. We're getting a narrative that doesn't really explain. I mean, in many ways, you can argue that the Palestinian-Israeli struggle is a struggle of one group of victims against another group of victims. And who is the greatest victim who has suffered the most? There you go. And in this case, we don't really understand until we see this film about the daily life of Palestinian people. And what is remarkable about it is that they still maintain a nonviolent posture. Of course, there's been violence in the past and in the recent past. and you're hanging by a thread there, and you're left thinking, how long can this go on? How long can they keep restraining themselves?
For me, the force of the film is the tone of it, the tone and the narration, the fact that you see all things that he might experienced in his life and the villagers of the West Bank experience, all this suffering, but for never for a second he says, you did this to me, or accuses the soldiers, or complain about this. You know, this is what happened to me. Just have a look at that, experience what I've experienced, and that's it. So we're not wallowing in these emotions of the suffering. And I think this is a very refreshing presentation of harsh reality because it inspires you. You look at suffering and it's not used as an instrument. It's, you know, this is what I've experienced. I'm not going to use it as a tool. You know, just experience with that. And I think this allows a lot of viewers to get away from this game of who's more victim and suddenly to be inspired of the people. And then it creates passion in you to create change in reality. So for me, I also like Imad. For me, the film is, you know, is for general audience, for anyone who wants to watch it. Also, if you're not interested about the subject at all, it's just a very good emotional journey that kind of teaches you something about life and about how to deal with suffering. So for me, this was what I had in my head when I experienced, when I was in Belin and when I met Imad. But of course, there's for anyone, there is kind of a special audience. And for me, the special audience were the Israeli youth, because these are the kids. I imagine myself when I was 16 or 15 or 17, I didn't know anything about what's happening. And I was supposed to be enrolled in the military, like these boys are supposed to go to military. And I imagine, you know, these boys, they have to know where they're going to be posted, what they're going to do. And this is the time for them to create change, because once they're in the military, they're entering to this this brainwashing machine in which you cannot get away, and it's too late for them. And it was almost too late for me. So for me, this is the most ideal audience for Five Broken Cameras. And by the way, it's the most difficult audience to access. I always said it's easier to get into the Oscars than to put the film in Israeli schools, because Israel, they have no problem in showing the film and being proud of it when it's shown abroad in festivals or getting to the Oscars or even in Israeli television. But try to get to the educational system, and there you find the doors are closing. So you have to really, you know, and maybe the Oscars will be our way to get in.
Well, but from the American point of view, it seems to me that here in the United States, we have a special responsibility to educate ourselves about this situation, because almost every day in the newspaper, there's a headline about Israel and to a lesser extent, Palestine. There's no question that Israeli politics weigh heavily on Washington. We just had recent hearings for the new Secretary of Defense, who was beaten up because he was perhaps not sufficiently pro-Israel. And the dialogue was so absurdly pro-Israel, it was embarrassing. And Israel is still the biggest recipient of U.S. aid, even though it's a very successful and wealthy country. So Israel dominates so much of our media and so much of our political attention, but we get nothing back from it in the sense that nothing changes. You have a peace process, but you don't have peace. You know, it just goes on endlessly. And, you know, a lot of people are just tired of the whole thing. But at the end of the day, what I find so powerful about your new film, Five Broken Cameras, is that it really is the ground truth and a truth that we're not seeing. So I think there's a special obligation on the part of Americans to pay attention to it, because in many ways, America is the enabler of this political situation that's going nowhere, because it needs adult supervision, surely.
We have talked earlier about also the Jewish community, but not just the Jewish community in the U.S. that is probably mostly very liberal and is not happy with Israeli occupation. But the problem is that there are certain steps that need to be taken that the Jewish community or generally in the States is very difficult to take. for instance, trying to stop U.S. aid for Israel. Look what that's going to happen. Maybe if we're going to do that, maybe the regime will change. Maybe the government will change, will be replaced. Because, so as long as America is not willing to go further on, and especially the Jewish community, and we're thinking that this is a good step, this is a positive for Israelis, this is a pro-Israeli step. You know, it's a pro-Palestinian, first of all, but it is pro-Israeli because occupation is ruining Israel. It's not because economically Israel is good that the country is good. The country is in a very, very bad shape, and that's a result for 45 years of controlling other people. So, you know, so we need this kind of friends to be able to tell us, hey, stop, and not to say it in a delicate way and then to continue on because it's not comfortable, but to say it strictly and taking strong steps to stop the government's actions.
So, Ahmad Banat, there's not a lot of politics in your film in the sense that you don't talk about, in fact, there's no politics about the Palestinian issue, about the so-called peace process. There's a brief moment where a couple of Palestinian politicians show up, but the impression I got was from the film and from you and your friends that are portrayed in the film that these people are distant from your lives. So in your village, right up next to where the Israelis are moving in and confiscating your land on a daily basis, and you see this encroachment throughout the course of this film that goes from, 2005 to 2011, I think. So give me a sense of, as a Palestinian, how you feel about this so-called process and about Palestinian governance, because recently a bunch of documents were leaked to Al Jazeera that indicated that the Palestinian Authority had really been completely useless in the peace process. And my understanding is a lot of young Palestinians are frustrated with their government, just as throughout the entire Arab Spring, the youth are rising up against these corrupt and distant and ineffectual governments.
Yeah, the Palestinian people are not happy at all about the peace process, because it's been negotiating the peace process for more than 20 years and we get nothing from this. The situation is getting worse. So the politicians have their language to speak and to make a very beautiful speech, and we were joined by a politician in the village, but in the end they have their language to speak, and they have their way to speak, and to sometimes to use some events for political needs. But for me, is the reality is more important. What's going on the ground? What's happening? What's the people in the village are doing? What's the struggle? So we've been facing many kind of pressures of occupation and different kinds of pressures, and some pressures of from politician also. So the politician and the peace process is not it's not useful for the moment, and we should find a way to get out from this, and to give the people a new way to get more about reality and about the life, about what's going on. And it's important for me that the Oscar will draw big attention to the Palestinian issue, and billion people around all the world will be informed about the Palestinian issue, about the life, and I hope that they go and watch the film, and so they can get more about our life. So it will be very big success for the Palestinian in this case.
Well, just in closing, Guy Davidi, the film actually makes you angry too. It makes you feel the deep injustice of what's going on. And obviously, Israel is more and more isolated. It's the Europeans have all but given up on Israel. Israel still has tremendous support and sympathy here in the United States, but I think that's starting to slowly change as well. So to that extent, it seems to me that curiously, there's another Israeli film up for the Academy Award, too, The Gatekeepers, which is about the Shin Bet officers. And I know you're in competition with it, but in many ways, it feels like this is a moment for, you know, almost these films are companions in a way, you know, that this is a moment for us to get an education about what's going on in Israel and between Israel and the Palestinians from the documentaries, not from our media. I think our media has failed us. You know, I'm not blaming them. And our politicians have failed us. And it seems in a curious way that you filmmakers are the ones that are really opening our eyes.
There are two things to that question. First of all, I think there were many years that films about occupation were produced in Israel by Israelis, speaking about what we're doing to Palestinians, but then speaking about ourselves at the end. You know, so we're using the occupation to speak about the immorality of our society, about the corruptions of our society, about our self-conflict, about whether we should act with violence or not. So we're taking this whole, what we're doing to other people and referring actually to ourselves. And that's exactly what I didn't want to when I joined the project. I said, for once, we're going to work to make a film that I will be there to empower his voice. And the result of the film is, first of all, is a Palestinian story. So it's, you know, of course it is a co-production and there's Israeli and I'm Israeli, of course, but basically it's a Palestinian story. And that is something that, I'm sorry, but there are many films that were done about the subject, but not from that perspective. And that's something that is new. So to get with that perspective, with getting someone from who's from the movement itself, who had the Palestinian story, telling it from within to America, to worldwide audience, that's something I think that is not being done before. So for me, it's historical and it's a big achievement that I'm very proud of.
Well, I thank you both for joining us.
Just let me a moment to clear one thing. It's very important for me. As I want to say, just sometimes the media is make wars, the media is make conflicts, and the media is change the reality. As you said before, the other Israeli film, this film is not Israeli. I want to say it, I say it always. This film was born in the village, and this is my story, my village story, and my people's story. So when I propose guy to work together, we work together. Sure. like a human, like a friend, not to make Israeli Palestinian project or to make
right.
it.
I'm very glad you corrected me on that, because that's a very important correction.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ahmad, for your film. It really got to me. A very, very powerful and a very effective film. Again, Ahmad Bernat's a Palestinian farmer and freelance cameraman, a photographer. His work has appeared in Al Jazeera, Israel Channels 1, 2, and 10, and Palestinian television. And Guy Davidi, who's an Israeli documentary filmmaker and cinema teacher. He's been directing, editing, and shooting films since the age of 16. He's made a number of shorts and documentaries, such as In Working Progress, Keywords, and Women Defying Barriers. His first feature film, Interrupted Streams, premiered to great acclaim at the Jerusalem International Film Festival. And he's now launched a campaign to bring his Academy Award-nominated feature documentary, Five Broken Cameras, which Ahmad Bernat's film, in effect, to Israeli youth. And, of course, it's available now on DVD at Netflix, iTunes, Hulu, Amazon, Google, and video-on-demand outlets. And it's, again, up for the Academy Awards. I thank you both for joining us here and for bringing this extraordinary film to our attention. And we will all wait with our fingers crossed for the Academy Awards. Thank you. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.